and a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the podcast with you 24/7, 365 by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. Our show this morning is brought to you by The Law Group. You can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. More on them coming up a little bit later on in the program this morning. We've got some big international news as it relates this morning to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. According to details out yesterday evening, the United States and Ukraine have signed an economic deal, this mineral rights deal that we have been talking about and has been a topic of conversation over the last couple of months, has apparently gone through. As the announcement was made announced yesterday, an economic deal made after a weeks-long back and forth between President Donald Trump as well as individuals in Ukraine to compensate the United States of America for billions of dollars in military and economic assistance to help Ukraine and the ongoing war between them and Russia. The Treasury Secretary and Scott Bassinet made the announcement on his X account last night. You don't need to hear from me. Let's hear from the Secretary himself.
Thanks to President Trump's tireless efforts to secure a lasting peace, I am glad to announce the signing of today's historic economic partnership agreement between the United States and Ukraine, establishing the United States-Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund. This partnership allows the United States to invest alongside Ukraine to unlock Ukraine's growth assets, mobilize American talent, capital, and governance standards that will improve Ukraine's investment climate and accelerate Ukraine's economic recovery. The Development Finance Corporation will participate and help to establish this fund in collaboration with the government of Ukraine. Today's agreement signals clearly to Russian leadership that the Trump administration is committed to a peace process centered on a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine over the long term. It's time for this cruel and senseless war to end. The killing must stop, and both the United States and the government of Ukraine look forward to quickly operationalizing this historic economic partnership for both the Ukrainian and American people.
Well, there's the Treasury Secretary last night in the video announcing this economic deal. It has been, you know, I think to say obvious since day one that Trump has attempted and continues to attempt to find a resolution to this ongoing conflict. Now, you listen to left-wing media and listen to Democrats, and they'll claim, oh, Trump is just a Vladimir Putin Russian puppet, right? That was the same thing in the first administration. No evidence of that ever came to fruition. And same thing now. So I guess the question I would ask this morning to individuals that have this mindset that somehow the Russian president has some superior control over Donald Trump, this economic deal indicates and shows that the United States, and you heard the words from the Treasury Secretary, that the United States now has a vested interest in the sovereignty of Ukraine. This economic deal proves that the United States wants Ukraine to continue to operate as an independent nation. Right? Because if that was not the case, if Trump was just going to fold over to the Russian dictator, like we've heard is going to happen for the last, you know, 9 years at this point, if that was going to happen, why would this economic deal, why would this have been signed? But that doesn't really make any sense. Ukraine's economy minister confirmed to the Associated Press last night that the deal has been signed in Washington. In a post on X, she said, quote, "Together with the United States, we are creating the fund that will attract global investment to our country." With that, the Ukraine said that they are ready to sign the agreement on their end. It's been signed in Washington. I believe it also needs to be signed on the Ukrainian side as well. And so with that, you know, this goes back to February when the original proposal was brought forward, in which Donald Trump said he wanted access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals as a condition for continued U.S. support in the war, describing it as a reimbursement for the billions of dollars in U.S. aid that the United States has given to Kiev. But talks stalled after that tense Oval Office meeting that happened back in February between the between Trump, Vance, and Zelensky. That thing completely blew up in the face of the Ukrainian president. Things seem to be heated, obviously, for a little bit, and then the things seemingly have relaxed. And since then, now this economic deal, economic minerals deal, has officially been signed. Meaning that with this, the United States now has that vested interest. The agreement will establish the United States Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund to help accelerate Ukraine's economy. The U.S. is seeking access to more than 20 raw minerals considered strategically critical to its interests, including some non-minerals such as oil and natural gas. Among them are Ukraine's deposit of titanium, which is used for making aircraft wings and other aerospace manufacturing, as well as uranium, which is used, of course, for nuclear power, as well as medical equipment and weapons. Ukraine also has some pretty large stockpiles of lithium, graphite, and magnesium, which are used in electric vehicle batteries. Those are some of the core components of making EV batteries. This deal is set to establish an equal partnership between the two countries to last for 10 years. Financial contributions to a joint fund would be made in cash, and only new U.S. military aid would count towards the American share. Neither party will have a majority vote reflecting an equal partnership between Ukraine and the United States. The fund is supported by the U.S. government through the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, as you heard there from the Treasury Secretary. Unlike an earlier draft of the agreement, this deal would not conflict with Ukraine's path towards European Union membership, a key provision for the government in Ukraine. Under the terms of the deal, the Ukrainian government will determine what minerals will be extracted and where. And with that, the United States will get a share of the new minerals that are extracted and taken out. This is, I think, a good deal. I mean, nothing in this is perfect. This war is a mess. But the whole situation is a disaster. But I think this is pretty advantageous to both the United States and Ukraine, right? There's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of years over bringing and having more manufacturing in the United States, even before Donald Trump. There's been a lot of questions about how many things that we use day in and day out are being produced overseas and reliance on foreign entities. The biggest example of this is, of course, China, where the United States, a vast majority of our economy, is propped up on cheap Chinese goods. And so when you specifically look at rare earth minerals and some of the things discussed in this mineral rights economic agreement between the United States and Ukraine, this makes the United States less dependent on places like China for some of these raw materials. The reason that electric vehicle batteries are not being made in the United States, a large part of it, is because the raw materials are not as plentiful here in the U.S. as they are in other places like China, like India, like many other places where these vehicles are being produced. Now, of course, we can have the overarching a larger discussion about some of the humanitarian crises that are taking place in many countries throughout the world to mine things like lithium and cobalt and other minerals that are being put into your electric vehicle so you can pat yourself on the back and as a good liberal saving the environment. Meanwhile, some 8-year-old is crawling through a cobalt mine somewhere, God knows where, attempting to mine that cobalt so that you can drive your $60,000 EV. That's a different discussion and a different conversation. But to me, this seems like a win-win, really all across the board. It signals to Russia that the United States is serious about this peace deal, which there's been some questions and there's been some discussion over the last couple of weeks. We heard from Secretary of State Marco Rubio last week, or maybe it was the week before, that if things were not progressing rapidly as it relates to the Ukrainian and Russian side of this war, that the U.S. was going to back itself out and pull out and say, all right, You know, you guys, nobody's willing to come to the table. Nobody's willing to negotiate. You guys are at a standstill. Like, at this point, it's not our problem. This indicates to Russia that the U.S. is serious about a peace deal. The United States now has a vested interest in the economic revitalization of Ukraine, which, again, signals to Russia that they're not just going to steamroll the rest of the country. There's not going to be any sort of peace deal that gives Russia back the territory that is now the country of Ukraine. That's not going to happen now. I mean, there seemingly is no way that that happens with this deal being signed. With that, the United States has now access to a stockpile of raw material, raw minerals, oil, gas, things, oil, natural gas, uranium, lithium, cobalt, some other sorts of materials as well. Talk about bringing manufacturing back to the United States, having some of that raw material available as an input for manufacturing. That's a huge win as well. This, I think, is a strategic long-term deal that hopefully will benefit the American people. You know, this was not something that had ever been discussed. And, you know, there's obviously always a lot of criticism of President Trump. He is a very different animal as it relates to politics. Yeah, you know, what's Taco Bell's saying? Think outside the bun, right? That's their whole thing. I mean, Donald Trump perfectly fits that. This is a guy who watched this situation unfold out of office for the better part of 3 years, watched in a previous administration who never picked up the phone to even talk to their Russian counterpart. Joe Biden never picked up the phone and attempted to talk to Putin to figure out, how do we end the bloodshed? How do we end the hundreds of thousands of individuals that were being slaughtered and have been slaughtered since the beginning of this war on both sides of the conflict? That never happened. There was never really a discussion, because he had never talked to Russia, literally not once. There was never going to be a discussion of a peace deal. There was never going to be discussion of actually bringing an end to this war through some sort of peace agreement, because it wasn't talking. The only solution from the previous administration was to just continue to write blank checks to the country of Ukraine. Now, that, of course, creates issues in itself. There's estimates and reports. I mean, this is back a couple of months ago. Zelensky claiming half of the money that the United States allocated and sent over is not accounted for. That money is permanently gone. God knows where that went. Who knows where that money was funneled? So that obviously was not a solution going forward. As I've noted many times in the past, nobody is going to win this war. Russia is not going to take over Ukraine. They don't have the military might to do it. If so, they would have done it 3 years ago. They don't. So they're stalled. Ukraine is not going to take over Russia and push them so far back that they're going to say the war is over. Russian war techniques are not going to allow that to happen. Nobody is a winner. The war is not going to come to one side wins, the other side loses, therefore the war is over. Nobody is going to declare, wave the white flag and say, I surrender, it's over. None of that is going to happen. And, you know, one of the great things and one of the things that I love about President Donald Trump is his willingness to think outside the box. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is a home run. That doesn't mean that everything that comes out of this administration, everything that comes, you know, every idea from the president and the people surrounding him, doesn't mean it always works. There's this weird idea. We talked about this last night on our monthly Zoom call with our Patreon members over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. You know, it's so ironic. The media seemingly expects perfection from Trump and his people. And that's, of course, completely unrealistic. Nobody is perfect. No administration is perfect. Not people surrounding you are not perfect. Mistakes happen. Things happen. So on and so forth. That's not a shock. That's not a surprise. And when you've got somebody like Trump, who is such an out-of-the-box thinker and is willing to come up with something like this mineral rights deal, this economic revitalization program that gives the United States this vested interest in the success of Ukraine going forward, because we'll get half of the new minerals that they're mining and bring, in many cases, digging out of the ground, whether it be cobalt, lithium, whatever. Right? Nobody else thought of this. Joe Biden never mentioned this. I didn't hear this from his Secretary of State, his Treasury Secretary. No discussion of this at all. It started in early February, just weeks into the Trump administration that the discussion of this mineral rights deal came to the forefront. That's been a little rocky since then, and hopefully it works out. It's not guaranteed that it will. There's no guarantees in any of this stuff. Could this not work out well for the United States? Maybe. Doesn't seem very likely. Very little on the hook for the U.S. here. We've already spent all the money. Right? The money's already been pissed away. We're not clawing that money back. Ukraine doesn't have any money to write a check to the United States to reimburse us for all of the military aid. So that's not going to happen. So this is a way for the United States to recoup some of that money, whether it's through actual cash or through raw material. So some vested interest there. And there's this idea of perfection that the media has, right? They will be silent under the previous guy. They were, for a large part, very quiet under mistakes with the Biden administration. Not a lot to say. Constantly covering up mistakes, ignoring controversy, ignoring issues. I mean, the entire media tried hiding the Hunter Biden laptop story weeks before months before the presidential election in 2020 to try and help Joe Biden. And it's funny because they claim that Trump is a deranged lunatic, right? He's a failed businessman. He's a liar. He's this, he's that. So that's the kind of the preface of everything that they say. So they claim he's a liar and he's an incompetent guy and he's bankrupt and he's a bad businessman. But then at the same time, they expect perfection from him. And I mentioned this last night on our Zoom call. You got to pick a lane here. Trump is either a completely incompetent individual. Therefore, anything that he does that is successful should be championed from the hilltops because he is truly so incompetent, as the media claims, that it's a surprise that he can get up and put one leg in each of his pants in the morning. Then on the other hand, you've got the media that wants to hold him to such a high level of scrutiny, such a high level of perfection. You can't do that if all of everything that you've said beforehand, the preface of everything, is he's stupid, he's incompetent, he's dumb. He's bankrupt, he's a failed businessman. I mean, you guys have to pick. He can't be both. You can't expect perfection from a guy that you claim is incompetent. Now, of course, you and I know Trump is not a failed businessman. He has built an incredible business real estate empire, loved by individuals on both sides of the political aisle. You know, it's kind of funny when you look at the way that Elon Musk is being treated now. It's not too dissimilar from President Donald Trump. Right? You go back to 2015 when he first announced that he was going to be jumping into this race, came down the golden elevators. At first, nobody really took him seriously. Then once he started getting on the debate stage and throwing his weight around and really rattling things up in the Republican primary process, individuals who loved this guy, individuals who had them on their shows, people like Howard Stern, Whoopi Goldberg, all of the individuals on the left now that have so much disdain for Trump, they loved this guy. They absolutely loved Donald Trump. Doing commercials for Domino's Pizza in the Trump Tower behind golden doors into his office. This guy was a loved individual on hosting SNL. Then he decided he was going to run for public office, and he's public enemy number one. So why would you guys have associated yourself with such a failed businessman and such a loser like you claim? But they all did. Then he ran for political office, and he's unhinged. Right? He's completely unhinged. He's an unstable individual. He does not have a successful business portfolio. He's a failed businessman. Of course, it's all nonsense. It's an attempt for the left to try and, I guess, cover up their admiration for this guy that they had in the past. And I see a very strong parallel between how Trump was treated prior to getting involved in politics to now as Elon Musk, a guy that was loved by the left, a guy that was the darling of the environmental wackos, the Green New Deal people on the Democrat side of the political aisle. They loved Elon Musk. He forced, with the invention of Tesla, the car, with the invention of that and bringing that to the market, he forced the hands of pretty much every other major U.S. automaker to bring forward a fleet of electric vehicles. Without Tesla really pushing that marketplace forward, EVs would not be what they are in the United States. Whether you like EVs or not like EVs, that's irrelevant to the discussion. He fundamentally changed some of the thinking around that in the United States. Now, for better or for worse, I don't know. We kind of completely skipped over the hybrid sector of the car industry. Very few hybrids. Of course, you had the Prius and some other cars. But we skipped over that, and then a lot of attention on EVs. Now, of course, some of that is being pulled back because the federal government was subsidizing these automakers to manufacture electric vehicles. The federal government was giving you thousands of dollars worth of tax breaks to go out and purchase an EV. That stuff is gone. The United States and the United States government should not, should never have been putting their finger on the scale as it relates to what kind of car you buy, what kind of car you purchase. It should have never been part of the discussion at all. And now Elon Musk is hated by the people that adored him, the individuals that were his biggest fan. They would have loved to have gotten 5 minutes with Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla and SpaceX, just 2 years ago. Hell, just probably about a year and a half ago. They would have loved that. Darling of the Democrat Party, darling of the left. And it's, again, not too dissimilar from the media elites and the Hollywood types that loved and adored Donald Trump before he got involved in politics. So with all of this said, I know I'm all over the place here. But with all of that said, you've got a guy that is willing to think outside the box. And that comes with its pros and that comes with its cons. Not everything works. Not every idea fleshes out to be something that is incredibly successful. But here's the reality. I'm okay with that. I am totally fine with that. And I've said this before. I said this about Joe Biden for years back on the radio show. My biggest frustration with Joe Biden was not the decisions that he was making. It was his lack of doing anything. My biggest criticism of the Joe Biden administration was their lack of action on nearly everything that was in front of them. Whether you talk about illegal immigration, whether you talk about these international conflicts between Russia and Ukraine, the Hamas terrorist group operating in Gaza and Israel, the port shortage and huge shipping issues that existed on the West Coast for months on end under Joe Biden's watch, trains blowing up in the middle of nowhere. The previous administration didn't act on any of this stuff. And I said that, I know for a fact I said this multiple times. I would be okay if Joe Biden would have just done something. Knowing that it's not going to be perfect, knowing that I may not necessarily agree with what he's doing, I would argue in most cases when you're at these high-level decision makers, more action is better than inaction or no action at all. And what you see with President Trump is he's willing to take action. And that puts the things that he does under a significant amount of scrutiny, a significant amount of pressure, and he knows this. The people around him know this, understand this process. He is not going to hit a grand slam every single time. Things are going to fail. Things are not going to work out. But I'm totally fine with that. I think that's good. I think that's the sign of a strong leader, somebody that is willing to do and try something. And if new information, new advice, new statistics, new data comes to light, they pivot. They make a change. They adjust. It's no different than, a football game. Obviously, the stakes are a little bit higher, sure. But if you're a football team and the defense is just not letting you run the ball up the middle, you're getting stopped at the line of scrimmage every time, you've got to change your game plan. You can't just continue to run the ball up the middle for no yards for three downs every single drive. You're going to lose the game, right? You see this happen in real time. That is not too dissimilar from what you see as it relates to the Trump administration and what I would argue governments all over the world, all over the country, local, state governments. You have a plan. You implement said plan. You figure out things are different. This didn't roll out the way that we thought it was going to. This implementation didn't necessarily work the way we thought. Okay, let's go back to square one. Let's adapt and let's move forward. I think that's the sign of a strong leader, whether you're talking about the president, the CEO of a company, or the head coach of a football team. Somebody that is willing to adapt with the situation that is in front of them. The left sees this as caving. It's all I've heard over the last couple of weeks. Oh, Trump is caving on this, caving on that. So you want the guy to continue with something that maybe new information shows is not fruitful for the United States? Because when you say somebody is caving, you're indicating that they're, understand that word and use that word, if somebody caves on something, they're losing. You're having to cave because you can't win. You can't win the issue. You can't win the battle, whatever it is. I don't see it as caving at all. I see it as strategically adjusting to when many cases are incredibly dynamic situations. The media sees it as a negative. I see it as a huge positive. This administration is willing to try things, knowing damn well that it's all not going to work out. But we're going to give it a shot. Now, of course, you've got to manage the risk with that. You've got to outweigh the pros have to outweigh the cons, sure. But there's always going to be the potential of some negative effects, some negative impacts, depending on the situation that is being dealt with. And that's okay. To me, that's totally practical, totally normal, and something that I would, in fact, want in a strong leader. And that strong leader is Donald Trump. The left can't wrap their head around it. The left does not understand the support for President Trump. But regular, everyday people that have to make tough decisions, have to constantly adapt to the environments that they live in, have to constantly change this, change that to meet the needs of you know, whatever story, whatever situation they're dealing with, they see Trump and they go, yeah, it's a guy that's making decisions. It's a guy that's adjusting things and handling situations that arise. To me, it is a huge net positive for Trump. For whatever reason, the media doesn't see it that way. As I mentioned last night, we were live on Zoom for a little over an hour and a half last night for our monthly hangout. We do those once a month for individuals that support the show financially over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Some new faces in there last night as well. You can support the show financially $5, $10 a month. If you believe that you are getting some value from the show, you enjoy listening weekday mornings, either live 7 a.m. on YouTube, Rumble, and X, or via the podcast feed, I encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig and support the show financially. I do want to thank a brand new advertiser we've got on board here on the Nick Craig Show, The Law Group. When legal challenges arise, trust The Law Group right here in Wilmington to help you out. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across Eastern North Carolina. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you need a strong defense, The Law Group is here and they have your back. Their dedicated team ensures that your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. They're located in downtown Wilmington, and they're just a phone call away at 910-251-6088. You can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. That's 910-251-6088 or online at lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication that you can rely on. Again, appreciate The Law Group and their support of the Nick Craig Show. We'll grab a quick break this morning. On the other side, I've got a wild video out of CNN's overnight news night show last night, the one that is hosted by Abby Phillips, the one you see that Scott Jennings is on a lot of the time, a wild clip from there last night, plus a major decision from the North Carolina Court of Appeals yesterday could have a major impact on the North Carolina State Board of Elections. All of those details and stories coming up here in just a few minutes as the Nick Craig Show rolls on live on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show. Good Thursday morning to you. If you're joining us live, happy first day of May. We've got a big decision from the North Carolina Court of Appeals yesterday as it relates to some power struggles ongoing in the state of North Carolina. We'll get into those details in just a couple of minutes. I have a couple clips for you this morning. This exchange last night on CNN between Anna Navarro, who, of course, for the longest time was a Republican, right? She was on The View for a while, I think. The typical Republican that it does not believe in any Republican or conservative ideologies at all, but plays the part for these various daytime and television shows so they can claim, oh, look at this, we're balanced. We've got both sides of the political aisle covered, even though this person who is a said Republican does not have any Republican ideals, does not have any Republican ideology in their blood at all, but they claim to be a Republican, so therefore they're the subject matter expert. She went back and forth with Sir Michael Singleton last night on CNN. This exchange got incredibly heated, so much so that Abby Phillips, the host of this show, threw it to a commercial break in the middle of these two arguing. Listen to this back and forth.
No, if you come into this country illegally, you are going home. Simple as that. We do not have unlimited resources.
I think a lot of Americans
to take care of other people.
There's a hell of a lot of people other than the black people who were brought here as slaves who came to this country illegally.
They are not the same as black people who were brought here against our will.
That's exactly what I just said. I said there is a lot of people
across the border.
There's a big difference.
There is a big difference.
That's exactly what I just said.
There's a big difference.
That's exactly what I just said. Sir Michael and Anna. Work and act indignant. That's exactly what I just said.
It's not about acting indignant.
Let me just hear you say
that. Other than the black people. There are a lot of people from
Michael,
many countries.
I think you actually misheard what she. Okay. I think you misheard what she said.
No, he purposely misheard.
She said.
I purposely misheard.
Yes, she did.
So now you're in my.
Cher Michael, listen to me for
is
just
that,
a second.
Is that where we're going?
Cher Michael,
I would say I will have advocated
Anna,
for black people
stop.
My entire life and
Anna,
say something like that.
Anna,
because
damn
you've
point.
Advocated for black
Anna,
people, great. Congratulations. Last time I checked, I'm black. You're not.
Okay, Cher Michael,
that's right. I'm Latino, and my people are being racially profiled.
It is.
And do I have to remind you the history of my people?
Cher,
if
I
you
have
want
to
go
know,
there,
I don't,
do you really
okay.
want to go
I
there?
I don't
there
know
right?
all the history.
Raul, we're
going
to go to break. Raul Reyes, thank you very much for joining us. Everybody else, hang tight. We'll be right back.
When I was studying history, like the president.
Oh, my God. What a disaster for CNN last night. Anna Navarro claims her people are being racially profiled. Since when is that happening? I'm not aware of any racial profiling that's ongoing by ICE right now. From everything that I've read, everything that I understand about the situation of illegal immigration that people like Anna Navarro created, right? This problem, let's just step back for a second. This was a big discussion on our Zoom chat last night. Most of the time we talked about immigration. This problem was single-handedly created by the Democrats. Multiple years of inaction by the president of the United States and Democrats in Congress allowed tens of millions of people into the country. They created this problem. It didn't just happen magically. You didn't just wake up one morning and all of a sudden there was 20 million more people in the United States of America. This was a clear attempt by Democrats to get people into the country illegally. They allowed it. They sat on the sidelines. They made excuses like Joe Biden claiming he didn't have the authority to do so. He needed congressional approval to enforce immigration laws that are already on the books. This happened because Democrats refused to do anything. And because of their refusal to do anything, it created a real problem. That real problem is now being solved by Donald Trump and the Republicans. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is going across the United States, getting federal arrest warrants for known dangerous criminals, arresting them, and throwing their ass out of the country. It's really not a complicated measure. But to claim that Latino people are being racially profiled is absurd. It's got nothing to do with race. It's got everything to do with coming into a country in which you were not welcomed illegally. That's what it's got to do with. Nothing to do with race. Nothing to do with sex. Nothing to do with gender or what country you're from. Simple fact is you allowed people to come into the country illegally. the American people who did not want these undocumented immigrants in their communities, wasting resources. In New York City, your kids are kicked out of school because the high school gym needs to be turned into a warming shelter for hundreds of illegal immigrants in New York City. People said, to hell with this. This is absurd. This is ridiculous. President Donald Trump ran a very strong political campaign with very strong messaging about solutions for illegal immigration, including mass deportation. Democrats were unwilling to accept that they created this problem. They ran a terrible candidate like Kamala Harris. She got her ass handed to her by Trump. Trump won the swing states, 7 of 7, won the popular vote, was inaugurated on January the 20th of this year. And to the surprise of Democrats, he's rolling out his agenda. People that are illegally in the country are in fact being held responsible for their actions and are being thrown out of the country. And in this weird exchange between Anna Navarro, who somehow is now the savior of African-Americans in the United States, she's claiming she spent her entire life advocating for African-Americans. I don't know what the hell that means. That's an attempt to claim that you're, an ally of this group, so it's okay to criticize them. I don't really know what she was trying to claim there. But trying to draw some sort of parallel between slaves being brought to the United States and individuals knowingly obscuring United States law, purposefully going around border crossing sites to come into the country illegally, is stone cold stupid. I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense at all. Cher Michael Singleton pushes back on her, calls her absurd, and says what she's saying is absolutely insane, which it is. This back and forth screaming match goes on, and then CNN has to go to a commercial break. But you know what I find really interesting about all of this is, you know, Anna Navarro claims that, you know, her people, because I guess she speaks for every single Latino in America. She's got because she is a Latino, she speaks for all Latinos. Didn't realize that's how that worked. I guess, you know, when I say something, I'm speaking for all white people. That's not really how that works. But again, when you're playing identity politics on the left, of which Anna Navarro is, then I guess you can make those claims. She claims that Latinos are being rounded up and racially profiled. But, you know, here's what's very interesting. When you talk to individuals who are Latino, who are legally in the United States of America, whether they were born here, whether they went through the legal immigration process to come to the United States, you know what you find out? You find out that they are incredibly frustrated with the problem of illegal immigration because they went through the process. They doled out the money, the time, the resources to follow immigration laws that are on the books for the United States of America. They see it as a huge slap in the face that other individuals who Anna Navarro claims are now being racially profiled decided to ignore all of that and just force their way into the country illegally. When you look at the crosstabs on political polling and look at the racial breakdown of individuals responding, depending on the poll and depending on how they do the racial breakdown, you'll see that individuals, typically they're described as Hispanic in the poll. Typically, you'll see that the Hispanic members polled are incredibly frustrated and incredibly against illegal immigration. So for whatever reason, Anna Navarro claiming that legal migrants from South American countries are okay with the rampant amount of gang violence that's existing in U.S. cities, thanks to Joe Biden and the Democrats allowing these people into the country, is a ridiculous broad generalization. And then, of course, you've got this, I guess, this claim that everybody is, anybody that's everybody that's not a white guy is racially profiling Latinos or Hispanics and trying to ship them out of the country is not based in any sort of fact, not based in any sort of reality at all. But it's a good talking point for the left. And that's really all they've got because they don't have the issues. Their policies and ideas, as you've heard me say, suck. Nobody's in support of them. They're very unpopular. And so the solution is to not bring forward anything that's popular for the American people, not bring forward any sort of solutions to a problem. It's to just bitch and complain on CNN and get into some racial diatribe over how somehow people crossing the border illegally in El Paso, Texas, is the same as slavery. Not sure how those things equate at all, but you know, I'm not a highfalutin individual like Anna Navarro over on CNN. So pretty great exchange there. Props to Cher Michael for pushing back on her crap. And of course, Abby Phillips and CNN. Oh, we got to go to a commercial because these people are having an argument and we couldn't possibly want that to take place. Turning our attention to some statewide news this morning, a major decision yesterday afternoon from the North Carolina Court of Appeals. They have blocked a lower court ruling favoring Democrat Governor Josh Stein in his legal battle with state legislative leaders and state auditor Dave Bolick over election board appointments. Josh Stein, not mincing any words on social media, saying, quote, "This decision poses a threat to our democracy and the rule of law," noting the only plausible explanation for the appeals court action is trying to help overturn the results of last fall's disputed state Supreme Court election, which continues ongoing this morning. An order Wednesday afternoon from a unanimous unnamed three-judge appeals court panel is set to pave the way for state auditor Dave Bolick, who is a Republican, to make new appointments to the state board of elections as soon as today, May the 1st. State law also calls for Bolick to take over administration of the election board. Stein, who is a Democrat, is challenging the law that shifts the state election administration under Bolick's office. As you know, this is a Democrat versus Republican issue. The appeals court yesterday afternoon issued an order called a writ of supersedes, blocking a three-judge panel's April the 23rd decision in the ongoing legal dispute. Back on April 23rd, a panel in a 2-1 split ruling ruled that the election administration changes spelled out in Senate Bill 382, which was passed in December by the North Carolina General Assembly, violated the state's constitution. The trial court panel ruled that the election board appointments should remain with Governor Josh Stein. And since then, that has brought forth a lot of very interesting discussions. And really what's at the head of everything here in North Carolina is whether the General Assembly has the authority, has the ability to allocate various executive branch decisions to other cabinet members. Josh Stein thinks not. This was his full post on X yesterday. Josh Stein posting, "Jefferson Griffin lost. When you lose, you work harder the next time to win. You do not try to change the rules after the election is over. Today's Court of Appeals decision about the Board of Election poses a threat to our democracy and the rule of law." You think the Democrats will ever get tired of saying that? You know, when you know it's the boy who cried wolf thing, right? When everything is a threat to democracy, nothing is a threat to democracy. When everything is a threat to the rule of law, nothing is the threat of the rule of law. You guys use these terms for everything. I mean, Donald Trump wakes up and eats a banana and you guys claim it's an existential threat to our democracy. You use this stuff constantly. It no longer means anything. When I see a Democrat say something poses a threat to our democracy, I laugh it off. And that's not good. I should not be laughing that stuff off. But when you use it ad nauseum, when you use it constantly, it loses its meaning. That's why the boy who cried wolf eventually got eaten by the wolf. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that nursery rhyme at all, but that's what happens. Cries wolf constantly. There's never a wolf. Cries it once more. There is a wolf and he gets eaten by the wolf. That's how the story goes, in case you weren't aware. It's the exact same thing with Democrats and threat to democracy. Donald Trump is an existential threat to our democracy. Republicans are a threat to our democracy. Jefferson Griffin is a threat to our democracy. The appeals court is a threat to our democracy. The General Assembly is a threat to our democracy. Maybe we should rephrase it. It's not a threat to democracy. It's a threat to radical, unchecked Democrat power. Now, that's what it actually is. But of course, Josh Stein's not going to touch that at all. Today's Court of Appeals decision about the Board of Election poses a threat to our democracy and the rule of law. The Supreme Court should not allow it to stand. I fear that this decision is the latest step in a partisan effort to steal a seat on the Supreme Court. No emergency exists that can justify the Court of Appeals decision to inject itself at this point. The only plausible explanation is to permit the Republican state auditor to appoint a new state board of elections that will try and overturn the results of the Supreme Court race. And so that's Josh Stein's political posturing on all of this. Let's look at what's actually going on here. Senate Bill 382 was passed by the General Assembly. That bill reorganized various appointment authorities within the executive branch of North Carolina state government. And it's important to note that the executive branch is not just the governor. We have 9 other Council of State members who run statewide elections and are voted on by individuals in all 100 counties in North Carolina. It includes positions like the state auditor, the agriculture commissioner, the treasurer, the labor commissioner, the secretary of state. I mean, there's 9 of these positions who run, many cases, contested primaries in their own party and then run a statewide 100 county election. These individuals are duly elected members of the executive branch in the state of North Carolina. So under Senate Bill 382, which was passed in December under Governor Roy Cooper, he vetoed it, the General Assembly overrode it, the General Assembly essentially scrambled and reauthorized various political appointments to boards like the Utilities Commission and like the State Board of Elections. The state constitution, nowhere in the state constitution does it claim that the governor is solely responsible for the North Carolina State Board of Elections. You will not find it in the state constitution because it does not exist. The state constitution, under my understanding and reading of it, very clearly lays out that it is the General Assembly, that they don't have the authority either, but that the General Assembly has the ability to define which levels of the executive branch, which elected people in the Council of State have authority over various boards and commissions. To me, it is clear as day in the state constitution. But we know that Democrats go through the process of sue till blue. You can't win the issue. You don't have the political power in the House and the Senate here in North Carolina to make the change. So what do? Bring it to the courts. That's exactly what Josh Stein did. He got it in front of a 3-judge panel in Wake County, 2 Republicans, 1 Democrat. One of the Republicans and one of the Democrats were ruled in favor of Stein, blocking the change, which is state law, by the way. It was passed by the General Assembly. This wasn't just some random thing that popped up out of nowhere. This was a law that went through the process of becoming a law, passed the House, passed the Senate, went to Governor Roy Cooper's desk. He vetoed it. They overrode his veto. This followed the process for every other piece of legislation that we see in the state. Josh Stein got it in front of a friendly 3-judge panel. The panel ruled in his favor, and he guessed he thought he was done. An appeal was made by Dave Bolick, by Republican leaders in the North Carolina General Assembly, and thus the process is working. Right? We're always told that we just need to follow the process on this stuff. This is the process. A Superior Court judge judges in Wake County ruled in favor of Stein. Legislative leaders and the state auditor appealed that to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, who saw the discussion differently. They went over the facts in the case. They looked at the merit of what's going on, and they ruled differently. That's the process. Now, Josh Stein is encouraging the state Supreme Court to step in on this. I don't think he's going to get a favorable ruling from them at all. But he's following the process, too. That's how this works. You leapfrog and kind of go through the various court channels. If you don't like a decision, you have an opportunity to appeal it. Doesn't mean you're always going to win. And in this case, as it stands right now, contrary to Josh Stein's ridiculously stupid post about the threat and the end of democracy here in North Carolina because of this decision, the appeals court ruled. They issued a writ of supersedes blocking the decision on April the 23rd from the three-judge panel. And also responding to this is State Senate Leader Phil Berger, the Republican out of Rockingham County. He said this, quote, "The Court of Appeals rightly affirmed what we all know. The governor is not the sole elected executive officer in North Carolina government. Despite that, Governor Josh Stein is desperately grasping to keep a partisan stranglehold on the Board of Elections instead of working to make common sense changes to improve election administration. North Carolinians deserve to have a Board of Elections that works for them. That's why the General Assembly reformed the State Board of Election last year to be under the authority of the State Auditor's Office, which is well-equipped to refocus the board's mission and restore trust in our elections." The State Board of Elections has been a mess. The way in which they have handled themselves, dealing with things like voter ID, the leadership that is existing in some of the 100 county board of elections, like in New Hanover County, where they just ignored state law and decided they were going to do something their own way because the hell with it, they felt like it. That's a serious problem. There are very real and serious and justified concerns in North Carolina as it relates to the State Board of Elections. People do not have trust that the state board is being run in the best manner possible. And that creates a problem for both sides of the political aisle. To me, this is not a Republican or Democrat issue. When you lose trust in the State Board of Elections, aka therefore losing trust in elections themselves, boy, does that create a chilling effect across this state. Democrats are always yelling and screaming about voter disenfranchisement. How about disenfranchising voters because they don't trust the Board of Elections? How about disenfranchising voters because they've seen the just blatant lawlessness from the state board? That's a huge concern for me as well. Democrats don't want to deal with that. Democrats, I guess, just want to assume that they're the ones that are best suited to handle something like the state board, even though evidence would prove that's not the case. Even though evidence would prove that they have mishandled something like the State Board of Elections, the General Assembly, under the constitutional authority, rewrote laws, changed the power structure, changed the authority, and now we're watching it go through the courts. This appeals court decision is a massive one. It's one that I think will favor North Carolinians as a whole, regardless of political makeup, regardless of political ideology. And we'll see if the state Supreme Court takes it up. I'm sure they will. And hopefully they can end this for once and all. Does the General Assembly have authority as written out in the state constitution to redelegate power within the executive branch to 9 other elected members of the Council of State? As from my understanding and in my opinion, they absolutely have the authority to do that. Democrats don't think that's the case, but at the end of the day, the courts will decide. And as it stands this morning, the Court of Appeals has decided. They have said that no, this previous court is wrong. They do, in fact, have this authority. So we'll watch this process unfold in the coming weeks and, of course, could have some major implications for the Jefferson Griffin-Allison Riggs race as well that we will continue to keep an eye on. Well, hey, that's going to do it for a Thursday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Coming up tomorrow morning, a major debate in the North Carolina General Assembly over diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'll have the sights and sounds coming up for you tomorrow morning right here. Again, thanks to the Law Group for their support of the Nick Craig Show. We're back with you live tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock, YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great Thursday.